Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachran, and you're listening to New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Richard Kent about the recent NCAA rule change that paved the way for student athletes to receive financial compensation. Richard is an attorney and an expert on the subject, and I hope listeners enjoy learning about how college sports, specifically college basketball, are changing. Richard, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Great, Caleb. I'm really happy that you asked me.
Of course. And, you know, before jumping into the topic, I just wanted to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background in the world of college sports.
Sure. I'm a graduate of Rutgers College and Boston College Law School. I was a litigator for many years, but I also had more than a few feet into the sports world. I've done color commentary for Yale basketball. I've been representing NCAA men's and women's college basketball coaches for about 7 years. And I've just, I've written 11 books, six of them on sports, two on Roger Federer, two on women's college basketball, and two on men's college basketball.
So for today, the focus that I want to have is on NIL, name, image, and likeness. And I was wondering if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about what this is and the recent rule changes that have just had such a significant impact on college sports.
Sure. There was a case called Alston versus the NCAA, which was pending out in the Ninth Circuit, which is the California federal system. And my partner in sports college coaching representation had a feeling that the NCAA was going to mess up again and take an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which it did, and lost the case 9-0. The U.S. Supreme Court decided the case with Justice Kavanaugh, who played JV basketball at Yale, writing a blistering opinion about the NCAA and everything the NCAA had done, including Mark Emmert, the president, earning $3.5 million a year, and many college coaches earning upwards of $10 million a year off the backs of college student athletes. So basically what the Alston decision tells us is that college student athletes, not football, not basketball, everything, are entitled under the appropriate circumstances to additional educational benefits. Those are the key words, additional educational benefits. And basically, when that ruling came out, state legislatures around the country, ruling came out in late May of 21, state legislatures around the country rushed to enact what we call name, image, and likeness bills with the football centric states, namely Alabama and Tennessee, and stretching up to Michigan, rushing to get their bills in early for this reason. It would be, and it was going to be, everybody prophesized, a huge recruiting advantage to have the universities in your school, in your state, be a position to offer money for name, image, and likeness. So these statutes started to arise throughout the country during the first, second, and third weeks of July. As you can imagine, the statutes in the more football-centric areas, mostly the SEC, were more liberal than others. But most of the statutes did have these key concepts. One, it can't be pay for play. There's got to be a quid pro quo. In other words, the college student athletes have to do something for the money that they're going to receive, not from the university, because in 2021, when this happened, the state statutes eliminated the universities from being involved. Now, that's been changed as we sit here in May of 2023. At least two states, Alabama and Tennessee, as you can imagine, permit the universities to be involved. But let's flash back to 21. So the universities can't be involved. We don't want student athletes supporting a brand which may be antithetical to the brand that the university is sponsoring. So if you're a Nike school, you don't want kids to be sponsoring Adidas or Under Armour. And also drug, alcohol, and gambling products are excised in most states. So the statutes come into being. We know that the schools can't be involved. And what happens is companies start to form, including a company which I'm involved in called SANIL, S-A-N-I-L, Student Athlete Name, Image, and Likeness. And the companies serve as the middlemen between the boosters, donors to universities, and the student athletes. So let me give you an example. We do the work at Penn State University. We did the work starting in 21 at Penn State, and we met with several key boosters. We got their names from various sources, and the key boosters decided to use us, but there's no such thing as exclusivity. So there could be 5, 3, 8, whatever collectives at various universities. So we interfaced, usually by Zoom, because it was during COVID, with these boosters, and we created what was known as a general fund or a student athlete specific fund. In a general fund, the boosters would donate money and give us discretion as the individuals who ran the collective to parcel out the money to student athletes, you know, under whatever subjectivity we were going to utilize. And that usually involves some consultation with coaches, or they were student athlete specific. In other words, we want the goalie on the lacrosse team, the point guard on the women's basketball team, and so on and so forth to receive the money. Now, in its embryonic stages in July, August, September of 21, it really wasn't out of control, but 2 years later, it's the Wild West, and it's a bidding war, especially out of the transfer portal, which has been revised to the extent that on a first transfer, Caleb, you don't have to sit out a year. So you could theoretically play basketball at Rutgers on January 12th and suit up at Michigan that you've transferred to on January 14th for a game on January 15th. So what's going on at the big schools is you've got 1,000 kids in men's basketball, fewer, but still a big number in women's basketball, and you've got bidding wars going on for these student athletes. So the rich are getting richer, and one phrase that's being used is that money that was given under the table before is now put on the table right now.
Can you walk us through what that recruiting process looks like and how the recruiting process has changed from the times before NIL?
Sure. You've got two different recruitment mechanisms. You've got high school kids who you're recruiting, and that process in football and basketball could start as early as the 10th grade. And you've got the transfer portal. And these big schools, the Power Six schools, I'm including the Big East in that, because they're the most powerful college basketball conference for my money right now. These Power Six schools are seeing, you know, they may be losing a kid to the NBA, a one and done or a two and done, and they want to pick up an immediate impact kid you know, it could be a kid from a mid-major who just blossomed. So you could have a Michigan looking at a kid from Towson University who's a 21-point scorer and taking that kid. You've got Northwestern this year taking one of the darlings from the Princeton basketball team, Ryan Langborg, because you can't play an extra year in the Ivy League, which is archaic, and that's probably going to change right now. The Ivy League is in the dark ages, as far as I'm concerned, on all of this stuff. So you've got Langborg, who's going to suit up next year for Northwestern, and you've got a kid, another kid from Princeton, Jalen Llewellyn, who's going to be playing for Michigan. He'll be the lead point guard, and Langborg will be the lead shooting guard. This never would have happened before.
And you mentioned the quid pro quo. So what does it actually look like? You know, the boosters, or you know, the collective or company identify players that they want to give money to. They can't do it directly through the school. What does it actually look like? Is it through a signing? Is it through something else? What does that look like?
Well, you started the sentence with quid pro quo. It can't be conditioned on performance. And so that's not pay for play. It can't be pay for play. And there's got to be some element of return by the student athletes. Let's say if Joe Smith, a donor for Rutgers, is going to donate money, and he owns a car dealership in New Brunswick, New Jersey, the student athlete or athletes to whom he's going to donate are going to do Instagram posts or a signing at a table on a couple of Saturdays in September or October at the car dealership. So that's the quid pro quo.
How do you see this affecting the just general landscape for competition in basketball specifically, and then maybe in more general sports? Is it impacting how certain schools are able to perform? Are other schools that previously weren't that good suddenly able to be much more competitive because they have more money?
That is the case, but we can also look at a school like Fairleigh Dickinson, who defeated Purdue in the first round of the tournament. Fairleigh Dickinson, having chosen something that very few schools do on the D1 level, Tobin Anderson, who was a Division II coach, and they hired him as a Division I coach. He restructured their roster. He brought in some kids from a highly successful Division II school, and they beat a one seed, Purdue, in the tournament, which is unheard of. So they got richer by the transfer portal. But, you know, the bigger schools, Michigan, as I just mentioned, with Llewellyn, Northwestern will be stronger next year with Ryan Langborg. So you've got schools. UConn lost a couple of kids. UConn lost a player to St. John's because he's probably going to be a lead guard at St. John's. UConn has a couple of guys, including Andre Jackson, who were looking at entering the draft. They've hired agents, but they haven't. They've hired certified agents so that if their takeaway from the NBA, I think on or before May 27th, I believe, is that they're unlikely to be drafted, they'll probably go back. And, you know, UConn is looking for contingency plans right now. I mean, I was with Danny Hurley last night, the UConn coach, and Tom Moore, their lead recruiter, and we were talking about that stuff.
You mentioned that, the president of the NCAA making $3.5 million, some coaches making upwards of $10 million. Can you give an impression of how much players, stars, are going to be making through NIL this coming year? And not just stars, but just, you know, maybe someone who's a good player at a smaller school, or a backup at a pretty good school.
Yeah. So we're looking at the lead players at Power Five schools in basketball, a kid that's going to be a starting point guard making in the $250,000 to $350,000 range. We're looking at a kid who's going from one mid-major to start at another mid-major in the $25,000 to $50,000 range. And in women's college basketball, and you look at, and I don't know any specifics about LSU, but you look at how that roster was restructured, you know, with Angel Reese coming over from Maryland, there's female college basketball players making upwards of 100,000.
And with these new rules in place, do you think that it's going to result in a greater emphasis on individual branding, individual playing versus more team play? Because college basketball is such a team sport. Could you see it just starting to look more like the NBA as time goes on?
Well, I think what you're really insinuating or want to talk about is whether or not there's going to be a locker room issue.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Is there going to be, and there's been a study done already by a group out in California. And the feeling is, or at least the feedback has been, that only in about 5% of these situations have there been locker room issues created. So I think it seems to be pretty much under control that way.
And, you know, I know you stated that this came out of a court ruling, and I'm wondering, you know, do you have a sense of how NCAA leadership has viewed this? Have they ultimately embraced the new rule change? I imagine that they are probably able to keep stars more. What sense do you get about how people generally have perceived this new change?
Well, you used NCAA as a result of this. I don't know if it's a condition precedent, but it's certainly close to one. Mark Emmert had a step down, and the NCAA hired Charlie Baker, who was the governor of Massachusetts and a former basketball player at Harvard. So the NCAA had to react that way, because I don't think they were terribly happy with Mark Emmert's tutelage on this whole process. Basically, the key word for the NCAA is they abdicated. They did nothing, and they sat and watched the state legislatures put together bills. And there needs to be federal legislation. I have met by Zoom with Senator Tuberville's office in Alabama and Senator Joe Manchin's office in West Virginia, because they're trying to co-author some federal legislation which would provide for uniformity.
In addition to a high school player's option to go and play on a college basketball team, there's also developmental league teams out there like G League, Ignite. I'm wondering how the relationship between how you've seen the relationships between these sorts of organizations change. Is there more of a move away from these sorts of organizations towards college basketball? Did this save college basketball in a way?
I think they're going to get hurt a little bit, because if kids can make the same dollars in college, why go to the G League? Why go to Ignite? Make your 150 grand and then hope to get drafted. Or, you know, hope to get a two-way contract with the NBA.
Do you see any downsides to the new rules? You mentioned that there's a push for uniformity and for these rules. What are you hoping to see to just make things easier?
I'm hoping there will be uniformity. I'm hoping there will be federal legislation. But if you and I had this conversation in 2 years, we're going to see two new elements involved. We're going to see... There's a case in the Philadelphia federal system in which student athletes have sued for the right to be deemed employees of the university and to get paid the same way that, let's say, a football player would get paid the same way as a kid working in the library at a school. For this reason, the football or basketball player is spending 30 hours a week doing this, no different from what the kid in the library is doing, is being forced to tailor his or her course schedule to be consistent with the practice schedule of the football or basketball team. So why shouldn't they get the $16 or $18 an hour? So that's number one. And number two, there's no doubt in my mind that at the Power Five level, with the $1 billion TV contract for an entity like the Big Ten, you're going to see revenue sharing for the student athletes. Do I know the number? No. It could be 8%. It could be 12%. It could be in that range. So if there's a $1 billion TV deal, the student athletes may end up parceling out $100 million.
College basketball and all college sports really are so international. Players from all over other countries, every continent come and play in college sports. How does a different nationality or different citizenship impact a player's ability to get paid under NIL?
Excellent question. So kids are here on a student visa. Under the student visa, not permitted to get paid in this country. the first example of a workaround, that's the dispositive word right now, workaround, was by a Kentucky in John Calipari with a player named Oscar Tshiebwe. And Oscar Tshiebwe got his NIL money. It's my understanding, I didn't work on this at all, while the team took a trip to the Bahamas last August. So you can be paid outside of the United States. Examples that I've seen in my own business model are kids from Canada putting up billboards in Canada for an entity or a company owned by a booster in the United States for the school they go to, and advertising the product or the person's name on the billboard and getting paid in Canada, opening a bank account in Canada and getting paid.
That's interesting. So there's tons of different, just incredibly creative workarounds that you can always do. I'm sure people will find new and more creative ways to go about finding ways to pay players. You mentioned the sort of the big six leagues and how they are, really dominating. How do the small, more of like the mid-majors, how are they competing? Is this going to harm them, or are they finding other ways to make this work?
Some mid-majors, and I'm going to call them more low majors than mid-majors, are advertising as follows. Come here, play for 2 years, put up big numbers, and you didn't get recruited by a Power 5, Power 6 out of high school, but you will after your sophomore year.
Right. So it's, there's almost like a two divisions inside D1 itself that is maybe over time might become clearer in the way in which players go about things. And I'm wondering, is it the case that, the best kind of classic blue bloods are the ones that are doing the best at fundraising, or are there some schools that are just blowing others out of the water when it comes to fundraising for college players?
Both. I mean, you saw Rick Pitino leave Iona, and he had vowed to stay at Iona, didn't have to travel too far, traveled over to St. John's. He can still live. He's got a house on Wingfoot Country Club. He can still live there and play golf there. But there's a really wealthy booster at St. John's, a guy that owns Vitamin Water, I believe. And listen, without him, you're not going to see Rick Pitino moving over from Iona to St. John's, and you're not going to see St. John's already signed a couple of kids this week. You're just not going to see that happen. So it's either one or two huge boosters or a cadre of boosters who put up $5, $10, $25,000 each.
And is there anything else that we haven't discussed, that you see sort of coming down the pike as far as ways in which college sports is going to change? You mentioned that it's, it's the Wild West. Anything unexpected that you think could happen, or something that could really shake up how things are already operating?
Well, the numbers are going to get higher for the NIL, and the numbers of kids entering the transfer portal is going to proliferate. So, it's probably going to be 10% more kids in the portal, and whatever the aggregate NIL money is right now in May of 23, it's going to be 25% more in May of 24. So that, that's almost a given.
And I know you talk to so many coaches. I'm wondering, is there a general opinion that coaches seem to have on NIL, a feeling that maybe this is good or bad? Are they trying to, I imagine you're an 18, 19-year-old kid, you come in there and someone's offering you $1 million that could turn your life around. Maybe you start behaving poorly with that money. Is there any concern, worry that you see when coaches talk?
Let's talk about three coaches who don't coach anymore because of this. Jay Wright, Villanova, Roy Williams at North Carolina, and Mike Krzyzewski at Duke. They won't say this on the record, but I'm pretty sure that if the transfer portal and NIL hadn't happened, they might still be coaching. Let's put it this way.
Interesting. And, do you see, what impact do you see the NIL, these rule changes having on the NBA? Are players going to spend more time in college, or do you think that the potential offers that the NBA can give to a star are just so great that it wouldn't really matter?
You're a first rounder, you're going to the NBA. If you're an early to mid second rounder, you're probably going to NBA. You're going to hesitate maybe late second round or free agency and stay in college. I mean, that's pretty close to reality.
My last question is, who's going to win next year, men's and in women's?
Well, let's start with women's, because I think, like in the old days when it was UConn and Tennessee, next year it's going to be UConn and LSU. No reason to play this season. Just play that game in Cleveland whenever you want. That'll be the championship. With the men, it's too early with the portal, but I would be stunned based on how the Big East performed last year and how they're performing in the portal. If you didn't see, I'm not going to say they're going to win it, but if you didn't see on the final weekend, at least one, if not two, of Creighton, Xavier, UConn, Villanova, and Marquette, because Villanova's gotten a lot stronger in the portal.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for being a guest in the New Books Network. It was great to talk to you about NIL and how college sports are changing. I'm sure there will be a lot of new changes to come in the future. And we'll talk to you again to see if a new law gets passed, what that will look like. So thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.